from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Michael Krasny. In this hour, the do-it-yourself or DIY movement has inspired millions of people to make their own holiday presents. Everything from soap to jams and honey to greeting cards, candles to, well, just about anything you can think of. And now the DIY movement is branching out into the right to repair movement, which wants to give consumers the ability to fix high-tech gadgets like iPhones and iPads. And as you can imagine, companies like Apple are fiercely opposed. We'll have that, plus a report from City Hall, where San Francisco's mayor has chosen the person she wants to replace, public defender Jeff Adachi. We'll get started right after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. In a moment, we'll be talking about the right to repair movement. We'll tell you all about that. But first, KQED politics reporter Guy Marzorati joins us from San Francisco City Hall, where Mayor London Breed named a new public defender to replace Jeff Adachi. Guy, what can you tell us?
Hey, Scott. Well, I mean, I think this press conference today was very much billed as a transition. Breed announcing Manoh Raju as the city's new public defender. Not a huge turnover in the office because Raju's been in the public defender's office for 11 years. So very much a continuation of the work, I think, that Jeff Adachi established for the office. And you heard a lot of praise of the mayor's pick from people inside the office who wanted continuity and wanted to kind of build on the foundation that Adachi has brought.
And what does Raju do now in the office? What has he done up to now?
So he's been managing the felony unit. So he's both managed other lawyers as well as pursued his own cases. And he's gotten, you know, praise today in both regards. Matt Gonzalez, who's the number two at the office, former supervisor, former mayoral candidate, said Raju is the best trial attorney he's ever seen. And so, you know, he has the respect of the office. And I think that's important if they're going to continue to kind of build on the work that Adachi has brought. Some specific things Raju mentioned. Is building more representation of African-Americans on city juries. That's an issue that he's pursued and he expects the office to continue to build on.
Now, the last time there was a vacancy in the office, Willie Brown was mayor and he appointed an outsider, Kim Burton, who was then challenged by Jeff Adachi, who was inside the department. Of course, he won. So your sense is that that kind of revolt from inside the public defender's office is not brewing this time with Manoh Raju? Yeah.
Definitely not. I mean, you saw just at today's press conference, so many members from the office show up and give him a huge round of applause as Breed introduced Raju. I mean, it remains a big wild card, the fact that because this position, a rarity in California, is elected, Raju will not only have to continue the work of managing and running the office, but he'll now have to step into the political sphere. And as you mentioned, you know, be on the ballot in November. So that certainly is something that, you know, he voiced as a challenge for him coming up and something that he'll have to quickly acclimate himself to in the next few months.
Yeah, and of course, as we've reported it, since Jeff Adachi died, San Francisco is the only county in California that elects its public defenders. And I just wonder, you know, what is your sense of Manoh Raju in terms of his public presence? I mean, is he going to be someone who, you know, you can easily imagine giving press interviews and going out and campaigning?
I think so, and I think definitely he is someone that I can see, you know, winning over that trust of not only we see he has the trust of the office, but the trust of the community in the sense that he views the public defender's office as very much as a public-facing office, not only representing the clients that they're given, but also going out into the community. I mean, that's something that he brought up again and again. The legacy of Jeff Adachi that he hopes to draw on is someone who would be in the living rooms of his clients and getting to know the families and really being out there and establishing a public presence, which certainly is a vital part of being an elected official.
And Guy, a lot of people thought that Matt Gonzalez, who you mentioned is the chief attorney in the office, he was sort of doing the day-to-day operations after Jeff Adachi died. Many thought he should be the public defender to be named by the mayor today. Did you get a sense that he wanted that job? Did he speak today?
He did speak today, and, you know, again, he praised the selection that the mayor made. You know, there's been some made of the fact of Breed's relationship with Gonzalez possibly holding him back from being named to this position, but he's going to stay with the public defender's office, I think, continue to help Raju manage this office in this transition period. But he had, you know, nothing but good things to say for this election, mainly because it was a continuation, and there is not going to be an expected clearing of house. It really will be a continuation of the work.
All right. KQED politics reporter Guy Marzorati joining us from San Francisco City Hall. Guy, thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott.
Again, that announcement, Mayor London Breed naming a new public defender. It's Mano Raju, heads up the felony unit, and we'll be hearing more about him in the coming days for sure. Well, now we're going to pivot to something completely different, as Monty Python used to say. If you're like most people, when your cell phone or laptop breaks, you either take it to, say, an Apple dealership to fix, or, like a lot of people, you toss it and get a new one. But the right to repair movement is on the rise. It's aiming to change that dynamic. A growing number of DIY groups are offering classes and online instructions on how to fix everything from iPhones to Wi-Fi-enabled refrigerators. But technology companies not so thrilled. They're discouraging those efforts, citing safety concerns. Advocates of the movement contend that even modern electronics can be repaired safely with less waste if people have access to proper tools. So let's dive into this movement. We are joined by Kyle Weens. He is co-founder and CEO of iFixit. Kyle, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
And also Nathan Proctor. He's director of the Campaign for the Right to Repair from U.S. PURG, I guess. Is it? Tell us what that acronym is. I forget sometimes. Policy something. Nathan?
Public Interest Research Group.
There
yes.
you go.
U.S. PURG.
Okay, PURG. Thank you so much. Appreciate that. Well, tell us, first of all, Nathan, why do we need a campaign for the right to repair, and what is it exactly?
Well, if you've noticed that your appliances and your devices don't last as long as they used to, you're on to something. And in fact, you know, all the devices that we have now, we have electronics, and so many of them are getting harder and harder to maintain. And it's really by design. The companies that make these products refuse to kind of give access to the things that are necessary to repair them, the spare parts, the service manuals, and the repair software.
And who is inclined to fix their iPhone? How many people would you guess? What percentage of iPhone users are going to take it apart and fix it?
Well, I mean, there's a good case study in that, which was that last year, actually like about 15 months ago, it was revealed that Apple was throttling the processors in a set of their phones if a phone detected that the battery was degraded. And they did this, you know, they say to kind of, you know, reduce bugs. But a lot of people felt like their phones were being slowed intentionally to get them to buy new phones. And once this was exposed and turned into a scandal, millions and millions and millions of people went to fix their batteries. And this was, and this, in fact, that impact on the market was so big that it changed, you know, Apple's sales kind of outlook pretty significantly, and hurt their bottom line because people were fixing the batteries of these phones instead of just assuming that a degraded battery meant that it's time for a new phone.
And Kyle Weens, are we talking about things breaking, or is it, you know, so there's also this sort of planned obsolescence where phones, you know, kind of outlive their usefulness in a sense because there are new additions to the new models that people want or are enticed into wanting. How much of what you're describing here with this right to repair movement is aimed at that versus just, you know, fixing something that's broke?
Right. I think that's a very interesting question. It comes down to what is the arc of progress? How quickly do we need to replace these things? I remember 10, 15 years ago, there was a joke that when you bought a laptop, it was obsolete by the time you got home from the store. But that's not really the case now. Laptops, you know, most people are fine with a 4-year-old laptop. And we're starting to see that with cell phones now, where 5 years ago, you really needed to get a new phone every 18 months because the acceleration was so fast. But now if you have an iPhone 7, you're perfectly fine with a couple-year-old phone. So we're seeing a plateauing of new features rolling out in these new phones. And as a result, people are needing to maintain, they're needing to keep their old devices around longer. But one thing that's really different now from the laptops back then is the batteries weren't glued into the laptops the way they are in phones today.
And why was that change made?
You know, I think it's interesting to look back. The first device with Gluten battery was the iPod, and people had problems with it back then. It's really interesting that we have these devices in our pockets that all of us use where the battery is built in and designed to last 18 months, and none of us really realize it. If you bought a car and it had tires that were welded to the frame and you had to go back to Ford in order to get your tires changed, people would think you were crazy. But that's what we've got with cell phones right now.
And Nathan, there is an environmental aspect to this as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, Americans throw out 416,000 cell phones every day, and that's kind of what we, you know, enter into the waste stream. And, you know, and a cell phone takes a lot of resources to you know, make. It's a lot of mining and manufacturing that goes into that. And about 80% of that, you know, the climate impact of a smartphone is the manufacturer, and only about 20% is the continued, you know, charging of it. Electronic waste is the fastest growing waste stream in the world. Something like, 125,000 jumbo jets worth of electronic waste are generated and thrown out each year. And, you know, by far the most efficient and easiest way to reduce that waste is just to keep the stuff we've already made working.
And Kyle, why do we need a right to repair? I mean, you don't need a right to repair your car or change your oil.
Yeah, great question. And actually, you do. There's no way local mechanics would exist if we didn't have existing right to repair laws on the books for cars. In the past, Ford and GM and the big automakers have really tried to monopolize the auto service industry and push the small garages out of business. And so there have been a series of laws, the most recent in Massachusetts in 2012, that the automakers agreed to apply nationwide that require the car manufacturers share the information with local mechanics to be able to fix things. And it's worked surprisingly well. That's why you're saying we don't need a law. Well, you don't know you need a law because we've got it. We need that kind of protection in place for consumers for other kinds of products, not just vehicles.
And what would happen if somebody fixed their own iPhone?
Well, they do. Every month, about a million people are using iFixit, which is my website, to repair their products.
And so, but again, the idea that you have a right, it suggests that if you fix it, you could be in trouble without the right.
Well, and, you know, this is something that we find increasingly challenging. A lot of products have those stickers on them that say warranty void if removed, where people feel like they're being penalized if they open their products. Last year, the FTC ruled that those stickers are not only unenforceable, they're illegal. You can't put stickers like that on products anymore, which is fantastic.
Yeah. I'm going to open up the phone lines. We're hoping that this is a topic that our listeners might want to weigh in on. If you've tried to fix your cell phone, if you'd be inclined to, if you had more information or any other software-enabled gadget, 866-733-6786 is the number, 866-733-6786. You can also email us. It's forum@kqed.org. Talking with Kyle Weens, co-founder and CEO of iFixit, and Nathan Proctor. He is director of the Campaign for the Right to Repair for U.S. PIRG. And we're joined now by someone else who is not so thrilled with this movement. Earl Crane is a security advisor for the Security Innovation Center. And Earl Crane, you've been listening to the conversation. What concerns you and your group about this right to repair?
Thanks for having me on. So I don't have a specific issue with people wanting to fix their devices. My concern is that they do so securely. And so we've had a lot of conversations about securing our supply chain and ensuring that we have the appropriate elements for supply chain security. And the reality is that repairing your toaster or your paper shredder is not the same thing as repairing a sophisticated internet-connected computer that's part of a global supply chain and can introduce a lot more complexity rather than just your toaster.
How would changing a battery in a cell phone change the security?
So when you change your battery, it's included with other electronics as well. There are elements of registering capacity, registering load, drain, and there's a lot more sophistication. It's not like swapping out your AA's and putting a new one in. And the second piece of it is that by opening up the device, it violates the integrity model of that device, which means that the manufacturer's supply chain is also invalidated, and that also affects the other components.
So are you saying that your group sort of like supports the right to repair with caveats?
What we're looking for is to support a secure repair. So there are already secure repair options and secure repair capabilities in place today. And we want to make sure that users are able to still get their devices securely repaired. And the challenge is that some of the legislation that's being proposed opens up the genie out of the bottle, that it will be difficult, if not impossible, to still maintain those secure repair options once all that information is made public.
And Nathan, there was legislation in the, I believe, State Assembly here in California that died in committee. What are your thoughts about the security issues that Earl brought up? And is that what companies like Apple, who I'm sure opposed the bill, argued?
Well, in California and in some other states, Apple doesn't argue directly against the bill. But they do support organizations like the Security Innovation Center, which are, more or less their express purpose is to defeat these bills. I would say this, that mostly this security thing is not really a real issue to oppose right to repair. By far, the most secure option for repair is having control of your own repairs, right? If you work in a super secure environment and you wouldn't want to trust any possible contamination of the pieces of equipment, you would want to have your own technicians have all the original manufacturer parts and the correct schematics to fix it yourself.
But doesn't that argue really for taking it to the dealer, to whoever you bought it from?
So, that's what Dr. Crane is saying when he says we need to protect these secure repairs. He says we need to make sure that the authorized and the manufacturer repairs are the only options, which to me is silly because I can fix my phone more securely than the Apple Store because I am the one doing the work, but Apple won't give me the spare battery. You know, he's talking about the supply chain, wanting to make sure it's completely secure or, whatever, it's in their walls, but they won't give me the spare part. So if I want to fix it myself, I have to go to somebody else.
Let me bring
and,
Earl.
And to me, this is just a non, it doesn't make, anyway.
Yeah, no, sorry to interrupt. Earl, let me just give you a chance to respond there to a couple of things Kyle said. First of all, does Apple, fund your organization, the Security Innovation Center?
I don't know who specifically. I'm an advisor for the Security Innovation Center. Mm-hmm. I'm a cybersecurity component.
And does your organization weigh in? Did it weigh in on this legislation that was in the state legislature last year?
Well, I can't comment on a specific state legislature, but more broadly, certainly, we've been able to share the same concerns when it comes to exposing the supply chain to having to open that element up and some of the health, life, and safety risks that are introduced in exposing that within repairing devices that are sophisticated and could potentially cause health, life, safety issues.
It would seem like when in the scheme of things, in the scheme of, how many the spectrum of security risks, that putting a new battery in your iPhone would be pretty low on the list. Am I wrong?
That is incorrect because, like I said, it's not like popping the back off of a remote control and putting a new battery in place. Because it's integrated as part of a sophisticated device, because it has different technologies that integrate to the battery, and to be able to get that much computing power into such a small device, we fall into a false equivalency where we think our sophisticated electronics are just as easy to replace and maintain as electronics of 10 years ago.
Kyle, let me give you a quick chance. Or is that Nathan?
Yeah, absolutely. This
go
is,
for it.
Yes, I'd love to weigh in because Dr. Crane is absolutely correct. There is a risk of getting a battery that has bad actor component in there. That's why it's so important that we get access to parts from the manufacturers. If you want, let's say you're Lawrence Livermore National Labs and you want to install a new battery in your phones in your secure environment, you can't take it out, you don't trust the $15 an hour Apple Genius, you don't have an option right now for a secure battery. What you want to be able to do is go and buy that battery direct from Apple from the trusted supply chain that you're talking about, but there isn't a process right now for doing that. And so we're actually in the worst possible security situation right now, where when manufacturers refuse to provide secure parts, people have to turn to the aftermarket, and the aftermarket has a variety of quality and potentially can have security risks. That's why this right to repair legislation is so important, to restore that trusted supply chain.
So the legislation would, say the one in California, would basically require companies like Apple to supply the parts?
Precisely.
All right, let's go to the phones. And Janet in Menlo Park, you're first.
Oh, hi.
Hi there.
I'm delighted to be on the air. I've never done this before. I am a huge advocate of repair cafes, and we have them in this area, in Palo Alto and Mountain View. And I can give you the websites. That'd be nice.
Well, tell us what happens there.
Okay, I'll tell you about it. They're a lot of fun. I always have a great time when I go. But I go to the one at the Museum of American Heritage,
okay,
which is on Homer in Palo Alto, very close to Whole Foods Market. And everybody there is a volunteer. Everybody is friendly. I have a great time. They serve coffee and donuts. No, sorry, coffee and bagels. And they take everything. I don't know if they do cell phones, but for sure they'll do heaters. They'll do any mechanical device that you have, even bicycles.
Huh. And who's there? Who's bringing their stuff in?
Well, people who live in the area. And I've got to confess, it's mostly slightly older people. Young people just throw it out, whatever it is. But those of us who've been around for a while realize that we don't want to go spend another $50 on a heater.
And so you hang out and just sort of watch everything that goes on. Why is it so much fun?
Well, I've been there and not taken anything to have it repaired.
Must have good coffee.
No, it's not bad. It's just that people are very friendly and it's very casual.
Yeah.
I donate a little something. I usually give them like a $20 bill or something because this is volunteer.
Yeah. Kyle, have you heard about these kinds of, excuse me, Janet, have you heard about these sorts of cafes and places where volunteers work, Kyle?
Absolutely. There's a global movement of repair cafes. There's thousands of these meeting groups all around the world where people bring their broken stuff. And if you think about a lamp that breaks, you generally don't want a different lamp. You like the lamp that you had. And so getting it in an environment where you have people with different kinds of expertise, you got people with sewing machines and people with soldering irons, and you get a chance to learn. It's really fun.
And Earl Crane, you're seeing a security nightmare here?
Well, I think this is actually an important point to bring up. I am also a fan of people repairing, preserving, not having to throw things away in those repair cafes, but it's a great point that repairing a lamp and repairing an internet-connected supercomputer that has all of your health and personal information are not equivalent. And that's the big issue where we start talking sophisticated supply chains. And the issue that even came up a little bit earlier, as soon as you start to introduce devices into the supply chain that you can't secure,
yeah,
that's where the problems start to come in. Even
All right.
if they're genuine, you can compromise their
security. Coming up to a break, Janet, thanks for the call. Earl Crane, I know you need to leave us, but thanks so much for joining us. And Kyle Weens and Nathan Proctor will be around for the rest of the hour. We're going to be talking about the right to repair movement. If you'd like to join us, give us a call, 866-733-6786. Email might be your best bet right now because the phone lines are pretty full, although you might give it a try. That email, though, is forum@kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny. Stick around. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer in today for Michael Krasny, who will be back tomorrow. We're talking about the right to repair movement, and joining us this hour, Kyle Weens. He is co-founder and CEO of iFixit, and Nathan Proctor. He's director of the campaign for the right to repair from US PIRG. And we want to go to your calls because we have a lot of people who want to weigh in on this. And we're going to start in Santa Clara with Stephen. Stephen,
hey,
are you there?
Good morning.
Hey,
good morning. Good morning, guys. Hey, so I want to thank you very much for putting this together. I'm a 30-year-old do-it-yourselfer. I've been fixing everything for as long as I can for my neighbors, my friends, my family. And pretty much anything that's broken, bring it to my house, and I will try and fix it.
What's your address, Stephen? I'm kidding. Don't give out your address.
No. But, of course, as time goes on and technology advances, it doesn't end just because, oh, you've got an iPhone. So I've fixed a number of iPhones, batteries, screens. I think it's a disservice to inform the public that, battery is proprietary and difficult to change. Absolutely, there's a learning curve. You're not going to swap it out like you do a couple of AA batteries. So you do your due diligence, study a little bit, but it's an opportunity to advance your knowledge, right? Swapping out an iPhone battery or a Samsung battery or even a camera lens, it's challenging, mm-hmm. But definitely doable. And iFixit website is where I get most of my materials from, so I appreciate that as well.
Yeah.
Just a couple of comments, that's all.
Okay, great. Well, thanks so much for the call. Appreciate it. Nathan, let me ask you, we've been focusing on, you know, phones and iPads and that kind of thing, but there are, in this movement really encompasses much more than that. And I'm just wondering, are you getting pushbacks from manufacturers of other kinds of products?
Yes, we get pushback from the manufacturers of basically every product. There's an Association of Home Appliance Manufacturers, AHAM, which testified in New Hampshire recently that if people could fix their own washing machines, maybe they would, you know, incorrectly, you know, put the latch back on and it would open up during its spin cycle and maybe maim a
drown the cat or
child. Yeah. And so, yeah, there's a lot of people from the motorcycle industry to the kind of snowblowers and lawnmower people. Basically, everybody who manufactures something now puts electronics into it that kind of tries to gate access to maintenance of that product. That's the business model that is being pushed, and it's happening everywhere.
Yeah. All right, let's go back to the phones. And Ron in Richmond, welcome.
Good morning. So if there's a legislative agenda for right to repair, I would sure like to see included on it the right to emulate operating systems when a company no longer supports them. And I'm thinking in particular here of the repeated need we find.
Well, I think we lost Ron. I'm not sure what happened there. But I don't know if either of you, Nathan, you want to weigh in on the beginning of his question. I mean, it sounds like there are other aspects to this right to repair than just getting the parts, right?
Yeah. I mean, so I think he's bringing up this problem that we're having, and Kyle could definitely speak to this, where companies create these internet-connected devices of some kind, and then that company stops supporting them or they get bought by a different company, and the devices just die. And this is
what's an example
problem.
Of that, Dick? Can you
I've got an example. Google bought a smart home hub company called Revolve. And a couple years later, they decided to shut off the servers that the smart home hub talked to. Well, that made the smart homes completely stop working. So if your home sprinkler is tied into your hub, as soon as Google shut the servers off, your sprinklers stop working. So what people would like to be able to do in situations like that is maybe make their own server, create an open source tool to replace the cloud services that are being shut down. And increasingly, as we have our internet connected things, the internet moves faster than kind of the world of physical things generally. And so we need ways of doing what the caller was suggesting, proxying, whether it's the operating system or a cloud service. And that's not something that's being discussed in right to repair legislation now, but it's something that we're having a lot of conversations about. How do we enable consumers to support devices after the manufacturers stop?
Kyle, what would you add to that?
This was Kyle.
Oh, I'm sorry. Nathan, I'm sorry.
No, I think that's 100%. You know, kind of a good summary. And then the other thing was that there was a bill in Virginia which didn't move forward this year, which would have kind of started to address that. So we know that legislators are considering how to put together language to get to some of these problems.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones now. A lot of people want to weigh in. Again, the number 866-733-6786. And Rob in San Francisco, welcome.
Thank you. And I love this topic. I love just trying to fix stuff instead of throwing it away all the time. But from somebody who has taken apart a few iPods over the years, it's getting really frustrating because they're designing them to not be messed with unless you're a professional. Because to crack these things open and not damage them in the process is really becoming difficult, not to mention all the parts are soldered in now. There's no pop-out anything anymore. So it really discourages anybody from even touching the darn things, whereas my LG phone has an easy-to-replace battery. It's a very thin. It was a top-of-the-line phone I bought about 3 years ago. I can still go out and buy a new battery for it, pop it open with my thumbnail, and pop a new battery in. That's like a dinosaur now. Nobody uses replaceable batteries, and I blame the manufacturers for something that it would have been simple for a user to just go to the Apple store, go to the LG store, wherever, buy a new battery when it wears out, and then pop it in. But no, now you have to send it back to a sophisticated repair place, and usually it's not worth the cost. You just throw it away and get a new one just because the battery's worn out. And this I blame on the manufacturers that just want to make money on repairs or a new phone.
Well, Kyle, what about that? I mean, is that really bottom line here, that these companies are just trying to protect their profits and sell you new stuff?
There's an extent to that. I think it's also being driven by consumer signaling. We're buying products, and we aren't necessarily rewarding the manufacturers that make easy to disassemble or easy to swap out products. In the laptop world, HP and Dell have products. We rank things on the repairability scale from 1 to 10 and how repairable they are. And both HP and Dell have laptops that we give a 10 out of 10 on our repairability score. Another product that you've seen explode in popularity is the Apple AirPods over the last year or two. And the AirPods have batteries that are completely impossible to repair. Place. No one, not even Apple, can swap out the batteries in those. Where Samsung just rolled out the new Galaxy S10 and their Galaxy Buds, which is the AirPods competitor, it is easy to open it up and swap out the battery. So I would say if you have a concern about something like this, buy the Samsung Galaxy Buds instead of the AirPods and send this bill to the manufacturer, that the ability to swap out the battery is something that matters to you.
And does Samsung work with an iPhone?
Yeah, absolutely. It's Bluetooth, so yes.
Yeah, okay, good. So you mentioned a couple companies there. Are in general, would you say, is Apple sort of at the bottom of the list?
If you look at the ultra portables, so the MacBook Pro and the tablets, Apple and Microsoft are at the bottom of our list right now, and generally trending toward the top of the list are Dell, HP, and Lenovo.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go now to Berkeley, and David, you're next. Welcome.
Hi. I work in manufacturing of consumer electronics at some famous tech companies that I won't mention, but I think two things. One, I wanted to respond to the repairability, you know, design for repairability, and I think that that's a very difficult thing with consumers demanding smaller form factors and, you know, higher battery life and all this stuff. There are a lot of engineering constraints that go into that, and repairability kind of is not the primary consumer driver. But on the other hand, I do think that the security aspect of the supply chain is a bit of a red herring because, I mean, I think it was Bloomberg article where, you know, there were these tiny chips being placed into the supply chain for the servers. You know, when you have a device like a credit card reader or something where, you know, it needs to be secure, there's a whole host of electronic techniques to secure that thing that you use that aren't used in phones or other electronic devices that are for the consumer. So, I mean, I think that the threat model for things that really need to be secure is very different than that of a phone. And I would also point out that, you know, PCs are repairable, and they're just as powerful as your phone, if not more so. And so, you know, I think some of this stuff, it's nuanced, and some of this stuff is a bit of a red herring with the security aspect, in my opinion.
All right, David, thanks very much for the call. And I should mention that we did reach out to Apple and ask them to be on the program. They declined to join us. Let's go back to the phones. And Mike in San Jose, you're next.
Yes, I have two questions. The first is, if one took an Apple phone, for example, into an Apple store, would they replace the battery if that's all that's wrong with it? And then second, if you can't do that, how does one find a reliable repair shop that addresses some of the issues brought up earlier about integrity of components and so on?
Yeah.
And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks so much. Kyle, you want to take that one?
Yeah, finding a good repair shop is important. That's where word of mouth comes in. Finding a good mechanic locally is something that's important. I like to compare it to finding an accountant. If you think about who are you going to trust to be an accountant, are you going to go with a national chain or are you going to go with the recommendation of somebody that you've done business with? I think someone who's a trusted, reliable local member of your community who has their reputation at stake is going to be a much more reliable repair provider and is going to provide you with a more secure service than someone with a large national chain. Or even at a manufacturer, so that tends to be my bias.
And what about Mike's other question about if you take a broken phone into a store, say to replace the battery, will Apple do that, or are they going to try to sell you a new phone?
You know, Apple has kind of mixed messaging of whether they're willing to do that or not. They did roll out a policy this last week where they said, hey, if you've had your battery swapped out by somebody else, they'll still repair it in an Apple store, which I think is the right thing for them to do. So I would hope, I mean, again, this is part of providing a suite of repair services that is flexible and customer friendly. And certainly, you know, if you repair something yourself and you fail, you ought to be able to take it in to have somebody bail you out. And I mean, we've all had this with cars too. Sometimes a mechanic will get stumped on the issue. Sometimes a dealership will get stumped on a problem. You take it to the local mechanic and they figure that in an hour.
I took my iPhone to Best Buy a few weeks ago because the battery was not keeping its charge. I think it's an iPhone 7, although it might be an 8. Would Apple then no longer cover, would no longer be under warranty, or do they have an agreement? Because they do sell Apple products.
Yeah, so it actually doesn't matter if they have an agreement or not. Under the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act, manufacturers are legally required to honor the warranty if you've had service performed on it by anyone. So within your 12-month warranty period, they have to honor the warranty, no matter what other repairs have been done to it, as long as those repairs did not damage the phone.
All right. 866-733-6786, again, is the number. And we'll go to Mill Valley. And Michael, you're next.
Good morning. I kind of bumped into this on YouTube, but there's a network of people that are learning how to fix their own Tesla cars. And the company kind of frowns on it. And the warranty.
You've met Rich.
And such.
Rich Repairs.
Repeat that?
You've met Rich, the Tesla repair guy.
That could very well be. And after that, there are two or three others. He finds them that have been wrecked or rear-ended, and they're like pioneers as far as digging into the batteries, electronics. So it's just American know-how. It's kind of neat. Another product I'm working on is actually a home kit embalming setup.
Embalming?
Yeah, when a family member dies, you can embalm them at home in your bathtub.
Wow. Okay. Well, that seems maybe a good topic for another half hour. But
if I could point out, the YouTube channel is Rich Rebuilds, and Rich has been buying Teslas that are like water damaged or have been totaled out by insurance companies, and then he'll buy two or three cars and he'll put one fully working car together, and he's been phenomenally successful at it. It's been really cool to see.
You're not going to touch the embalming question?
I'm not going to touch it.
Okay. All right, let's go back to the phones. Greg in Berkeley, what have you got?
Yes, hi. So thinking about durable goods having once really been durable, this is another sort of counterexample. I recently repaired my 60-year-old kitchen range when the oven went dead by myself and was able to find parts for it, an old Wedgwood, and you can still get parts. And just took a screwdriver and replaced the safety valve. And, the guy at the counter who helped me said, you know, you're not going to be able to buy a range the last 60 years anymore.
Yeah, Kyle, I think that's sort of what we've been getting at. But, you know, are there products that even you would say, you know, you really shouldn't try to repair that?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think it just totally comes down to your expertise and what you're comfortable with. People ask me all the time if they can do a repair, and they say, well, just go on iFixit. The instructions are free. You can look step by step at what's going to be involved and say, am I comfortable changing out the battery in my iPhone or not? Well, that's your decision. Look at the guide and see, and if you feel comfortable, great, go for it. And if you don't, hire a professional.
And I'm just wondering, you know, if somebody starts with your guide and gets into it and then realizes they don't know what to do and they can't put it back together, is there a hotline?
Well, we've got customer support, but I think also, you know, you phone a friend or you bring it into a repair cafe. That's where it's fantastic with these local communities, is you have this resurgence of repair across the state. There are more resources to fall back on, whether it's YouTube, whether it's our forums, these local events and community members, where I think people are feeling a lot more comfortable taking those risks now than even 5 years ago.
And Greg, is your range still working?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And it's gonna go longer than I will. I'm confident of that.
All right. Well, thanks so much for sharing that with us. Let's go now to Terry in Oakland. Welcome.
Hi there. I just wanted to give my husband a plug, actually. About 5 years ago, we bought a Prius. It was a second-year Prius made in Japan, and it was a salvage title. And about a year into owning it, the battery started to die, and it would have been about $7,500 to replace the battery. And my husband looked into it, and maybe $2,500 to replace a used battery, and I'm very thrifty. And he said, well, you know, I've been looking at YouTube, and I think I could replace, there's only a couple of cells that have gone out, I think I could replace them. So I said, okay, how much would that cost us? And he said, $20. So
wait a minute, $20. Yep. How do you get from, you know, 5,000 or whatever you said? What was it? $7,500 to $20
for a new battery, right? So, you there?
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm on my car phone. Anyway, the brand new batteries were $7,500, but it was only a couple cells in the batteries. Apparently, there are multiple cells in these batteries because it's him that fixes them, not me. And he could get those on the internet for $10 a piece.
Yeah. Kyle, would you have any – I'm sorry to interrupt, Terry. Kyle, would you have any concerns about, you know, something like that, just going online and getting, you know, what Terry describes? You know, we've heard all these stories about batteries in cars, you know, Tesla and others catching fire. I mean, you know, where is the line when you think about not security, but, you know, personal safety?
Right. Absolutely. You want to make sure that you do it safely. And there are a number of professional mechanics that have posted videos on YouTube on how to do precisely the repair that she just talked about. So it is something that you need to be careful with. You need to make sure that you do it correctly. But the same is true for a traditional battery. Like you have a lead acid battery in your car. You have to be careful with that or you can have a problem too. So car repairs are definitely one of those things you want to be careful. You can change the brakes in your car if you want. You always have been able to. Americans have been doing it for 75 years. But of course, you have to make sure to do it safely. And as we add electricity to the equation, it's just a different set of skills. It's not anything fundamentally different.
All right. Next stop is Fremont and Centille. You're next. Welcome.
Hello. Hi. I myself is a do-it-yourselfer, but it's frustrating to see manufacturers actually, you know, making things that is not easily, you know, fixable. But one of the influencing factor in this case is basically the consumer preference also, in my opinion. You know, even though there are lots of things out there in the field that is replaceable, but the consumers actually go and buy things that makes their life a lot easier is, you know, starting from your phones, like, you know, from old Nokia phones, you can just throw it on the wall, it just falls apart and put it back, everything would work. But now we are moving into something that is not openable. Same thing with cars. The same goes to your light bulb fixtures. Like, you know, that used to be like incandescent bulb that you can just remove it and then put the fluorescent bulbs for the energy efficiency. So now we moved on to LED. So they started selling like the LED bulbs that you can actually remove it and replace it.
Yeah, but, I mean, Nathan, now, we're just moving to a disposable culture. I mean,
right,
we have long
exactly.
ago, right? Nathan,
exactly.
you want to
wait
so on? Now, yeah, go ahead.
Now the whole wall fixtures is unreplaceable. The same goes with vehicles. Like, you know, a couple of my people in the North Circle, actually, they have this commercial heavy-duty vehicles from Volvo to, like, you know, John Deere equipment. And these things, like, when it actually runs out of, what do you call, the radiator fluid, then that one of the technicians have to come in and punch in the whatever the hash code to.
Yeah, Centille, we're short on time, so I'm going to stop you there. But I really appreciate the call, and obviously there is a demand out there, Nathan, for people who want to fix their own stuff.
Absolutely, and I think that if we want to have goods that we can actually fix that are repairable, you know, that's something that people need to speak out about. I think when we look at the just complete ramping up of basically disposable electronics, right? Glue-filled $1,000 smartphones that, you know, kind of can only last as long as the battery keeps going. You know, that is because we've tolerated that in the marketplace, that that's kind of, it's become the expectation. And part of what Right to Repair is doing is trying to set a different expectation. If we like it, we should be able to keep using it. And I think as we do that, we can start to push, you know, as Kevin was saying earlier, who were working at a manufacturer, you know, people maybe don't necessarily shop for repairability, but in part because they don't expect to be able to repair. And those things can go together. And Right to Repair is a great way to move that ball forward.
Is that more true in you know, highly developed countries, you know, like the United States, Western Europe, and, you know, Asia, parts of Asia? The notion that people aren't so interested in, you know, that, you know, fixing something, they'll just buy another version of it.
I don't feel like I'm an expert to talk about that. I mean, I have some anecdotal experiences which make me believe that, you know, people around the world without access to the OEM technicians are very resourceful to, like, keep their stuff going. And but, you know, I don't know if I...
No scientific studies on that.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go to San Jose now. Joe, welcome.
Hi, thanks for this great topic. I'm a big fan of Repair Cafe. I've used them once and hope to do it again. Anyway, in addition to this, a slight twist, I just would hope that maybe an ancillary part of this movement is to make all these parts recyclable. Everything should be cradle to cradle. There's no excuse for even just throwing stuff away. This is just we have 7 billion people on the planet. We just can't keep doing this. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call, Joe. Let's go now to Los Altos Hills. And Ken, you're on.
Oh, hi. Good morning. Thanks for having me on. And,
sure.
And thanks for the iFixit guy. I'm a common customer, and I really appreciate what you do. I fix a lot of stuff with the help of your website. But the reason I was calling in is the thing I drives me crazy, and I don't think it's talked about yet, is, you know, the impact to folks who are maybe a little lower income and who have, you know, limited resources. It drives me crazy when, you know, something maybe trivial happens with their equipment, be it their phone or their dishwasher, and a repair guy comes out and says, well, you know, yes, it's leaking and you need to replace a $600 pump on a $700 dishwasher. You know, it's not true that the pump costs $50 or $75. Likewise with a phone, it's a trivial fix, and yet these folks, you know, it's that might be their car payment or their rent for that month.
Sure.
And it just drives me crazy that they don't have more options and that there isn't more information. And I, you know, the guy earlier who was talking about how the you know, you're going to expose yourself to security risks by fixing these things. Sure, but you're going to expose yourself to security risks from all kinds of things. So throwing that up as an obstacle, I think, is really unhelpful to the conversation, and I think is just self-serving.
Kyle, to what extent, as Ken is suggesting, to what extent do, you know, folks who do repair work on, say, appliances, do they not have the information that they need to fix it and, you know, send you off to go buy a new one?
It's becoming increasingly a problem, particularly when it comes to more of these things are computerized. The lifespan of appliances is shorter and shorter. Like a typical washing machine or stove lifespan is only about 7 years these days. And the reason is that the primary circuit board is what fails. And so in order to allow those technicians to do repairs at more cost-effective prices, we need to have them to actually start fixing those circuit boards. And that's the kind of repair that the cell phone repair shops do. They have microscopes, they have soldering equipment, and if you have a capacitor fail on a circuit board, it might be a 2-cent capacitor that you can replace and salvage a $300 board.
Well, I'm wondering, would you say that, you know, there are obviously cars that are mostly now operated by software and computer have a lot of advantages? I mean, do you think that the advantages outweigh the problems that you're describing this hour?
Yeah, I'm not saying let's not put computers into these things. I'm just saying let's find a way to fix the computers when they break. So right now, the appliance world says, yeah, if the main computer in your washing machine goes out, maybe it's a $600 repair on a $700 washing machine. I'm saying let's fix that $600 part. And what the technicians need in order to do that is a little bit more engineering data than they have. They need the board level schematic. And if you have that schematic, you can say, oh, that's a 3-ohm resistor. I can swap that out and I'm off to the races. That's the kind of thing that right to repair legislation would help restore. And that's why I'm really looking forward to seeing right to repair legislation in California this year to address that imbalance. I think there's an opportunity to, yeah, help some of the poorest people in the state get back on their feet.
Interesting. All right, Ken, thanks very much. Now we're going to go to the East Coast and Graham in Virginia. You're next.
Hi, I've been in the tech repair industry for about 5 years, and I just wanted to add on to what the guy was saying earlier about aftermarket parts being a security risk. I don't believe that to be true. I think if you get the right aftermarket part, it can actually save you a lot of money rather than buying OEM parts. And the way I look at it is, if your spark plugs and your Mercedes went out, you wouldn't go buy the Mercedes brand spark plugs because they're like $400. You can save a lot of money if you get aftermarket parts, and I think that's crucial for recycling electronics that weren't necessarily built to be recycled in the first place.
Yeah, what kinds of things do you repair, Graham?
Anything from computers, desktops, laptops, game systems, mostly phones, though.
Yeah, do you have like a storefront operation, or how does it work?
I work for a small store that's now becoming a big chain. They don't know I'm calling in, so I don't want to say their name in case they don't want to be publicized this way. But people usually come in. We have filled out a little waiver that says, you know, it's water damage, we can't work on it. And then we open it up, fix it up with their choice of OEM or aftermarket parts.
Yeah.
And then we send them on their way.
All right. Well, thanks. I have to send you on your way because we're out of time, but thanks very much for calling in. Real quick, Kyle, where do you see this going in the next year? I think it was you that mentioned legislation, but you know, what would you like to see in the coming year or two?
We've had right to repair legislation introduced this year so far in 19 states, not in California yet, but that could happen soon. And we're optimistic we'll get this passed. And then what we need to see is a place where the electronic industry is like the automotive industry is now, where you have competition, you have access to parts and information from the manufacturers. I think we're really close to getting there. I'm also looking forward to more of these local fix-it clinics like we have in Oakland and Berkeley popping up.
Okay. Well, I'm going to have to leave it there, but obviously a lot of interest from our audience, so you've tapped into a nerve there. Kyle Weens, co-founder and CEO of iFixit, thanks very much, and also to Nathan Proctor, director of the Campaign for the Right to Repair with U.S. PERG, thank you as well. I'm Scott Schaefer here today. Thanks to all of you for joining us, all of your great calls and comments. Michael Krasny will be back, I believe, tomorrow, and you can listen in then. Thanks so much for joining us.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.